Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is the one and only Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Tonight, we tackled the big stuff, not only delving into the very coast-like topics of paranormal phenomena, specters and shadow people, UFOs and alien beings, but also the social constructs that affect how we view these subjects and how others view them, or rather don't view them at all. Why some take this stuff seriously and others don't give it a second thought. How our thought processes, our opinions, what we think of as our own beliefs are shaped and molded, in essence, decided by others. How free are we? And what does that have to do with, that freedom or lack thereof, have to do with the unseen worlds that we so often explore on this program? I am pleased to welcome two first-time guests to the show tonight, but in light of what I've learned about their work, I suspect they'll be back here many times in the years ahead. Coming up in a couple of minutes, a young filmmaker and paranormal investigator, you might say he has the conspiracy bug in his blood, maybe in his DNA. Sean Stone is an actor and director, like his father, movie legend Oliver Stone. Sean has recently released a theatrical film that's based on real-life weirdness that he investigated. You are most likely familiar with his work from the hit cable show Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. Sean's the guy who always seems to draw the short straw and gets sent on the most dangerous assignments for Governor Ventura's team. We'll ask him about his movie, about working on that show, and also for his take on the big picture issues, unseen worlds and beings, maybe the nature of reality itself, and the conspiracy theories that shape our core beliefs. Then in the second half of tonight's program, a newcomer to Coast, but not to the topics that we enjoy here. Brad Olson sounds like a guy with a job we'd all enjoy to have. He travels the world and then writes books about the places he visits. Cool gig. He's not only a successful writer, but also a prominent artist and a longtime seeker of truths, a passion that's led him to spend the last 4 years writing a book with what I would call a sweeping view of our world and other worlds. It's called Future Esoteric, The Unseen Realms. And man, it's jam-packed with the bits and pieces culled from many of the writers and researchers we know so well on this program. Secret societies, cover-ups, suppressed technology, UFO secrecy, reverse engineering, all that. We got a lot of ground to cover. And I will certainly give you a chance to ask questions of both of our guests during the course of this evening. One piece of news before we introduce Sean Stone. I thought that this particular story might be the best one to sort of, from the last couple of days, that is, to set the tone for where we're heading tonight. As you might have read, the U.S. Senate did something this week that it hasn't done in years. It passed a budget. This budget squeaked by the margin of a single vote, I think, but at least they passed something. It's been 4 years since they've done that. However, stashed way down in the innards, in the bowels of this budget bill, and I do mean bowels because that's where this belongs, what you might call the all-time Monsanto Protection Act, a special little attachment that no one seemed to say much about, but which has profound implications for all of us. Monsanto, we've talked about Monsanto a couple of times on the show. I'm sure George Norrie has got into it as well. As you may know, Monsanto is basically trying to own food. It now has the patent on soybeans. It's got this genetically modified soybean that pretty much dominates agriculture, with more genetically modified Franken crops on the way. All sorts of problems have resulted for family farmers because of this. Farmers that don't want to be owned by Monsanto, or who worry about the long-term effects of this stuff on humans who eat these soybeans and on the environment. Someone with a very sick sense of humor wrote this legislative rider into the Senate budget bill and called it the Farmer Assurance Provision. That's hilarious. The Farmer Assurance Provision sounds like something that would help farmers, right? Well, far from it. This section spells it out that Monsanto is essentially granted immunity from the federal courts for any review of its genetically modified crops that are thought to be dangerous. No one, not even federal agencies that regulate agriculture, can go to court to take this on because something that Monsanto plants might turn out to be harmful to humans or the planet. Have you ever heard something so outrageous in your life? I mean, this might be more egregious than the bailouts to Wall Street. One company gets special protection from any and all lawsuits or enforcement actions brought in federal court. You will not see this story on the evening news, at least I haven't. Chances are you will not read about it in your local paper or in national newspapers. Or if you do, it'll probably be a paragraph buried in a long, boring story about the budget. And you know what? There is almost no chance that this is going to be stopped. You know, the Senate's going to have to reach a compromise with the House on some kind of a budget bill, but they'll fight over cuts to this or that. They'll fight about tax rates, the overall spending numbers. They'll fight like cats and dogs. But this little special piece of legislative smegma will stay in the bill. And it'll get almost no attention, not unless the public raises all kinds of hell about it. And even then, I kind of have my doubts. One company gets its own special place in legal heaven, free from review by the courts. It is unflippin' believable. It's true what they say, I guess. This is Monsanto's world. We just happen to all live in it. Folks, I hope you'll look around for your own sources of information on this story, if you can find any, that is, online. And if you're as mad as I am about it, I hope you'll let others know as well. On that cheery note, let's take our first break and return momentarily with filmmaker and investigator Sean Stone. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. I want to mention one other quick thing. Our webmaster, Tim Benall, and I have put together our usual assortment of strange stories and news oddities. That stuff can be found in the Knapp's News section on the Coast to Coast website. Among the stories of interest tonight is one about new research into the healing properties of something called resveratrol. You'll recall I had as my guest earlier this year a guy named Bill Sardi, whose company markets something called Longevinex. It's an advanced form of resveratrol, a compound, and it's had some amazing results. I got a lot of messages from Coast readers who've tried it and what it's done for them. Well, finally, there's a new study came out this past week. Harvard scientists say they now have proof, the solid evidence that resveratrol really does have beneficial effects for humans in many respects. And the reaction from Big Pharma is exactly what you'd expect. They quickly moved to bury this stuff, to dismiss the results, to poo-poo the study, and they shut down some of the companies which would be there to market resveratrol. I guess, basically, if they can't patent it, they don't want you to take it. I have a story about the recent developments in our Knapp's News section. Also there, a short animated film titled Man, some musings about new findings regarding the Big Bang that we might talk about, and another about how humans are being given, in effect, superpowers. And oh, there's a story about crash saucers there, which is really about so much more, including the real-life guy who might have been the first model for Fox Mulder. It's a real good read if you get a chance to check it out. Time now to welcome our first guest. Sean Stone began his career by acting in his father Oliver Stone's movies, including The Doors, JFK, and Savages, to name a few. He has since starred in and directed Greystone Park, based on his experiences with shadow men, demons, and ghosts along the eastern seaboard at a very spooky old building that we'll talk about. Sean is also one of the co-hosts of Jesse Ventura's Conspiracy Theory TV program. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you, George. Thanks for having me.
I know we're not here to talk about your dad, but there's one question I want to ask that I think would help us know more about you. And I mentioned in the introduction, you sort of have conspiracy theories in your DNA. I mean, your father took on the ultimate conspiracy in his film JFK, and it was playing on one of the premium channels today, and that's one of those movies that if it's on and I walk by, I'm sucked into it all over again, no matter how many times I watch it. And then, of course, Wall Street took on the crooked bankers long before they crashed the economy, turned out prescient. I mean, what he told us about Wall Street turned out to be true. Growing up, did you talk about this kind of stuff around the dinner table or on the set of movies that you worked on, or did you just come to these topics sort of on your own?
Well, there's different levels to it. As you mentioned, JFK is, in a certain sense, an ultimate conspiracy because that assassination is almost, I call it, like a gateway drug. into the realm of occult politics. There's obviously many different theories about, you know, who was behind the assassination. And it, to this day, I hear people saying it had to do with Kennedy wanting to divulge the alien presence, which, you know, I think that he did have knowledge of it. I think there was FBI files that we know have been released of his discussions with Marilyn Monroe, where he mentions, you know, aliens or some kind of ET presence. But there's obviously theories of people saying that his desire to divulge that is one of the bases or the basis of him getting assassinated. There's the Vietnam theory, which was the main theory of JFK in my dad's film, about, you know, him not wanting to send troops to Vietnam. There's the monetary, the idea of the Federal Reserve system, monetary system, being responsible for the assassination because he was going to take us away from borrowing from the Federal Reserve and issuing currency from the Treasury, which he actually had done with the $2 bill and the $5 bill of 63, I believe. And, you know, certain executive orders, I'm not sure if you know the executive order I'm referring to, where he talks about issuing currency from the Treasury again.
Yeah.
Basically, as Lincoln had been the previous president who had done that. So if you look at Kennedy's assassination, it's like the sort of gateway into that world of conspiracy theories, right? And Masonic numbers around the location, I think 33rd parallel or something to this effect, in Dealey Plaza, and the Masonic symbolism around there. So when you, my dad obviously took a more mainstream approach as far as, you know, looking at the military-industrial complex being responsible. But growing up, you know, with a certain, you know, awareness of conspiracies, awareness of his research, I think I then was curious to take it to the next level, you know, which is to sort of open yourself to this the conspiracy theories around, you know, the secret societies and around, you know, UFOs and aliens. And, you know, you just take it from there, and it keeps growing, frankly, as far as your mind can wander.
There is sort of a natural progression, isn't there? You can kind of get sucked into the
progression, exactly. And I think, you know, my dad is not someone who, you know, would talk, you know, with me about things like aliens and whatnot. He once told me, he's told me a few things about people who've told him stories that he thinks could be credible. You know, basically that the film Men in Black is more real than not, for example. I think, you know, people even like Fletcher Prouty, who was the basis for the character of X, I'm not sure if you ever had him on the show or Coast to Coast, but Fletcher Prouty was had been in the Pentagon in the 50s and up to Kennedy's assassination. He'd been basically the liaison between the Pentagon and CIA, so facilitating CIA's operations with Pentagon's military equipment. And from that operational point of view, he believed Kennedy's assassination was a conspiracy, and he became the character of X in the film JFK. And Prouty, you know, some of his theories got farther out there, and a lot of people would just use his theories to discredit him. But, you know, these people are, you know, they're insiders. They have a basis for believing that. Whether or not it's, you know, sometimes it would be disinformation, but I think there's a lot of people who are inside the military, inside the government, who would, you know, who would say the UFO thing and the alien thing is real. And also, you know, there's a lot of spiritual factors involved. And this is another dimension, which I think ultimately you kind of have to come to on your own personal a basis of understanding, because, like, you can study all you want. Masonry, for example, and the hidden secrets, why secret societies keep, you know, mystery schools. But unless you start to actually have experiences of otherworldly phenomena in your own life and understand you cannot understand the interdimensional nature of these events. You can understand that this UFO thing is not purely physical, but also psychic and mental and spiritual.
You know, Fletcher Prouty, you mentioned, is interesting. Your father was on the program a couple of months ago. I was going to ask him about it, but it was way sort of off topic, considering that we were talking about his TV series and the book about the untold history. But Fletcher Prouty is somebody that I, when I first started chasing the UFO mystery, that I contacted. He was still alive back then. It's 25 years ago. And he was very helpful in guiding me. He didn't want to be quoted or anything. He's gone now, so I guess I'm free to mention it. But he was one of the ones who helped convince me that I was on the right path, that chasing these mysteries is not just a goofy waste of time.
Absolutely.
Did you ever meet him?
I think that's You know, it's unfortunate I didn't, because he passed away in 2000 or 2001, right before 9/11. And frankly, I mean, I really wish he would have stuck around a little longer. I know that he told my father he was very worried about going into surgery. As I recall, he had some surgery that was basically, you know, being encouraged by the doctors, and he was worried that if he went into, he would not come out of.
And sure enough,
he died very shortly thereafter. And it would have been amazing to hear his take on what evolved over the 2000s. The overall, I mean, right, I think what we have in the 2000s is just the complete takeover of the government by the what was then called the rogue or the shadow government in the 1980s. You know, the Contra cocaine operation, the enterprise of North and Bush Sr. really was the guy running it. Through the old boy CIA network, Ted Shackley, people like this. I think that whole shadow government basically took over this country from 2001 forward.
I saw a speech that you gave. I saw it online at something called the Schilling Institute or the Schiller Institute. And there you are standing up. You're a young guy. You know, you don't have any notes. There's no script. But it was very thoughtful. I think back to when I was in my 20s and I was a smarty pants know-it-all. But I don't think I could have given a cogent talk like this as you did, this worldview, what's wrong with the planet. It sounds like what you're telling us here, you've sort of carved your own path. Not only is on the same road as your dad, but you talked about the choice between whether we're entering a new dark age or something more optimistic and renaissance. Where do you lean, optimistic or pessimistic?
I think it depends on the day. You know, it's truly feels like a battle every day. You know, which you talked about Monsanto bill in the Senate. And here we had this farmer. You remember the case? It was recent. I think you probably must have covered it. With the farmer who was suing Monsanto, and I think he lost. But you know, it was obviously it was considerable effort on his part. You know, there's got to be some silver lining in the fact that becoming more conscious. Ultimately, you know, we can have a revolution in the sense of the ideas that we plant now, the seeds we plant now, will come to fruition. But we're fighting with a system that's so entrenched, and it's basically like it's a Titanic that's so full of holes at this point that it's just a question of if it will sink and bring us down, or if we cannot ultimately, you know, supersede it with using the principles of our Constitution, of our, you know, Declaration of Independence, but at the same time recognize that there's something fundamentally wrong with how we're doing each other and treating each other in the system. So whether or not it comes down and brings us all with it, or if it comes down and we let it sink and we basically order a new, you know, we create a new order that's like New World Order 2.0 in a sense, the more humane, take the most humane aspects of the new world, which is to say that we're, you know, we're more interconnected, we're more aware of each other as being human beings, as opposed to, you know, being from different countries. That doesn't matter as much. The fact that we're all human, we all share the resources of one planet, there's more sensible ways of doing things. So we don't have to go to their control, like an oligarchy's control of a socialist fascist system, but we can still be more conscious and humane as world citizens. You know, I think that's sometimes where people get into these pit holes, like, you know, saying you're either, you know, in favor of globalism, right, which is like a federated world government banking system, or you're a nationalist. Well, I think you can be pro-nation state in favor of your constitution and your system of law within your country, but not be a chauvinist. You can still be conscious of other peoples, conscious of the resources that we do share, that the common dreams and ideals of mankind. So that's what we have to aim for.
We've talked about it before on this program. I've expressed the view, and I hope a lot of people share it, is that, you know, so many of these disputes, you know, this Monsanto thing or the bailout of the banks, it gets bogged down in right versus left, conservative versus liberals. We squabble, exactly. You know, the people are banging heads over this stuff, essentially fighting for table scraps, while the big guys get all the goodies, you know, and they like us fighting at each other. Yeah.
Yeah, they create the system of conflict. I mean, that's a classic divide and conquer, going back to every empire historically. But I always say, when people ask me, are you left or right? I say left and right, those are two wings of a tennis court in France. where you pick up, you know, which end of the tennis court did you end up on? There is no left and right. You know, come on, we're sensible. We have common sense. We're humans. We know that we have in our Constitution, in the preamble, as a general welfare. You know, it's written into the Constitution, general welfare of mankind, or of our country, that is.
Sean, I'm going to take a quick break here. Sean Stone is my guest. We'll come back and talk about his movie and about conspiracy theory. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Sean Stone, filmmaker, and when we come back, we'll jump into a discussion of his new movie, Greystone Park, and also talk about his experiences with Jesse Ventura on the TV program Conspiracy Theory. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Sean Stone directed a movie called Greystone Park that came out a couple of months ago based on experiences with shadow men, demons, and ghosts at this very spooky and very large old building. Sean, how did you get onto this path? I know what I read about the film is that you and a colleague had a conversation about some weird experiences, and then you saw some things for yourself. What was it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, as you asked me earlier about how I got into the realm of conspiracies and whatnot, obviously growing up, as I said, I had done a lot of reading, and when you start researching the conspiracies, it takes you to secret societies. Secret societies lead you into what is considered occult, demonology, right? Black magic, rituals like this. I was fascinated by the Bohemian Grove and Alex Jones had videotaped there as far as that would look like a Moloch ritual, like cremation of care ceremony.
Yeah.
And so I was fascinated by the black magic world and what that actually meant as far as, you know, this worshiping of demons or Satan and whatnot. And I had never had my own experiences with it. So when I met my colleague Alex Wraith, who became my co-actor in the film and co-writer.
Wraith, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but the guy's name is Wraith.
Wraith. That was actually a comment we cut in the film, but I said, you know, what does Wraith mean exactly? It's like, what? You know, the Wraiths are supposed to be the sort of carriers between worlds, right? But in any case, the conversation was at a dinner table in 2009, October, when my dad was shooting at Wall Street 2. So I met Alex that night at dinner. We recreated this dinner table conversation with my father in the film, in Greystone. And literally the next night after meeting Alex, who had told me about this mental hospital, a very famous place in Jersey, because it was it may still be one of the biggest mental hospitals in North America, but at the time it was the biggest foundation until he built the Pentagon. And it housed, I think, at a maximum about 10,000 patients, including people like Woody Guthrie, and it's out in central Jersey. So, you know, he'd been breaking in over the years, been closed down for quite a while. Although it's an operational, there's a working Greystone next door, but the original Greystone Park is closed down. And he said, you know, he'd been breaking in over the years, and he'd been documenting with his video camera, trying to make a movie out of it. He said, this place is just, it's like The Shining, you know, because it's so alive that the location itself is the film. And, you know, he said, do you believe in ghosts? I said, I don't know about ghosts. I give it credit, but I give credit to people's stories, but I've never had my own experience. So sure enough, the next night, I took, a girl that I knew, girlfriend, I guess you'd call her, and Alex, and three of us broke in and went exploring. And, that first night, it was transformative, honestly. First of all, just getting, you know, the tension of going on to this location where you're breaking in, you know, you have police watching, they do patrols or whatnot, driving around, so you're already, your heart's racing, you're trying to just get into this place, and all of a sudden you're driving onto the property and you're looking up and this building is all lit up like a psycho. The house, somebody's home, or it's supposed to be abandoned, but it looks very much active. And we drove onto the campus and parked and hit our car, running for like about half a mile, and we couldn't find, the doors were locked, but then there was one door that was open, and there was a stick on the door. And so we stick aside, and I think we got in, and it was like, well, why is there a stick on the door? There's something weird about that. It was like a, you know, it was like a marker, you know. And kept moving, entering the place, and immediately it was like Twilight Zone when we walked in, because it's abandoned, but it's like no one left, because there's papers and couches and the lights are on, and truly it feels like someone's going to come home, you know, any moment. And so here you are, like, you know, three kids in this giant hospital, and we just started adventuring, and that first night, you know, I got more of the chills than anything, you know, the feeling that something's alive in here, and it's, you know, it's not just us, and you know, maybe it's fear, but Alex said he saw something, and he jumped and started running on one of the top floors, and you know, really freaked out. And then, you know, he kept, after that, you know, he said he saw this lady with her tongue sticking out of, like, you know, like a Gorgon face, you know, Medusa kind of face, slithering out of the ground right at him. And, you know, he was almost like dry heaving. But then he started acting a little bit possessed, and he wanted to keep going. And I, of course, wanted to pull out and just and go, but in time, you know, you know, we're all in this together, you know, and it's like it's on our car, and you don't really feel like the sense of urgency that, you know, you would think. It's just, it's more of like unease, but you're not quite sure what's going on. So we kept going. And it was that point, you know, when we kept going further, and of course, I had only known Alex for one night. I didn't know who the guy really was. He was a lunatic or, you know, a Satanist. Because he told me also that Satanists worship there. And of course, he says, if you run across a Satanist in here, you know, just do whatever they tell you. You know, he told me he'd come across one ritual one time where they were killing a cat, sacrificing a cat. And, you know, he had gotten out of there. But the point was that it was October 13th, the night that we were there. So as we're walking and I start to hear footsteps, you know, behind us and above us, I really grabbed Alex and said, get us out of here right now. And that's when we halt.
Hello?
That's out. Actually, Alex did have it in front of, outside of his house in the Black Cape for 2 weeks. He used to send me video footage of people outside of his house, like, taunting me. They were, like, Satanists, but he couldn't see their faces, you know, like shadow people, kind of black, all black. And, you know, we couldn't tell if there was Satanists inside that had tracked us because it's on the car license plate. We didn't know if it was, you know, like some kind of demonology going on. But that was the basis of the movie. that first, you know, that first night of encounter was what we wrote the script based on, and went on to have many more experiences and more confirmation of what I felt. But that first night really made me feel, man, I think this is a gateway to another realm. There's something here.
So you're in an admittedly excited state when you go into this thing. You're spooked to begin with. You're hiding from cops. You've heard about this building. I mean, you could just be imagining things, your imagination running, or did you see something more concrete on one of your visits that convinced you this is real, whatever it is?
Yeah, well, the truth is that, you know, there's a very, it's hard to explain because I know you've done work on The Skinwalker, and
right.
There's some, you know, what I wanted to, with the film Greystone Park, what I wanted to do was to convey to the audience, there is something else out there. But how much of it are we manifesting through our own fear, through our own energy? Because I've, you know, in the course of investigating and, you know, having been to dozens of haunted places, I've had rocks thrown at my head from out of nowhere. I've had things thrown and hit me on empty corridors. I've been in Greystone one time. We heard music, like church music, playing by itself. And there were three, four of us that were looking at each other. One time we saw somebody downstairs in the basement, and we didn't know what the fuck he was because it was like he had a flashlight, and I didn't see him, but we were with a cop. It was a cop, myself, Alex, and I think my brother, four of us, and the cop and Alex both saw him and freaked, but he had a flashlight. I saw the flashlight. I never saw the face. But they said it didn't look quite human, and some of the pictures we have were almost looked like a reptilian kind of creature, like very greenish face. It was like peeling off. And, you know, so this is the kind of thing where you go, what are we dealing with? You know, what is this dimension are we entering? Is it, you know, when I thought of Greystone, the name reminded me of the Necronomicon, which is called the Mad Arab Journey. And they said, you know, that Lovecraft created the Necronomicon from nothing, but I always believed that there was a previous tradition, a Babylonian book of spells, essentially. And, of course, Necronomicon will become famous again now with the Evil Dead film coming out. But I think that there's something to it. So when in the Necronomicon, the opening, they talk about the mad Arab. He's not mad. He's the Al-Azred. He's called the mad Arab. When he came across these black magicians for the first time, he says he sees them levitating a gray stone. It's very particular, a gray stone.
Huh.
And they're moving it. And then the snake is slithering out from underneath it. So for me, it's like Greystone was my initiation. It was my the first level of my initiation into that world of demons and also madness. You know, because as we know, the MK Ultra experiments and whatnot were taking place at places like Greystone, right, where they're doing experimental treatments and techniques for mind control, brainwashing, but they're also studying that realm, which is to say, what are people that are called crazy really seeing? Are they seeing something there that's just beyond our sense perception? You know, that's beyond normal sense perception, let's say. And what is it, a mind state that they go into? I mean, how do you explain it? You know, obviously, drugs like mushrooms and LSD, right, are part of those experiments. But I think that, you know, just judging from the work of, I'm sure you've heard of these people, the Collins Group, that Nick Redfern talks about, that they said that there's a tremendous connection between black magic rituals and portals and for UFO activity. So if you have a place like Greystone where we know Satanists are coming in, I saw occult symbols all over that place, Satanists are coming inside and practicing their magic. Are they creating portals? What does a portal mean? You know, what dimension are they entering? What are they bringing in? What's staying? You know, when you feel negative energy, you know you feel negative energy. So as you said, it could be fear, and yet we know that there's something being practiced here for a reason. Why are Satanists being drawn to this location, Greystone or Letchworth Village in New York, which was also meant a hospital for kids? Places like this. Why are they? What is it about this place? Like, what is it they're drawing upon? I would, you know, I'm still investigating. I'm still curious because I don't scientifically understand it.
Well, scientifically, scientists would tell you you're full of baloney, but others
well,
who are
scientists.
Yeah, I mean, but there are some who would say, look, you know, it's worth looking into. Is there a physical explanation that would make this, take it out of the realm of paranormal and put it in the arena of science, that there is some kind of a law of physics that we're not quite clear on yet that would explain why we have something like a ghost or a shadow person or something?
Well, that's why they're doing studies at Skinwalker Ranch, apparently, right? Presumably.
Well, we'll get into that. We'll get into that a little bit later.
Right.
I was just seeing if you had developed
doing this, yeah.
Whether you had your own theory on this stuff or not. You think there are actual ghosts in this Greystone Park?
I think Greystone is haunted. Haunted by what? I can't tell you. I think it's a portal or some kind of gateway. Not like a stargate. Not quite like a stargate, but something. You know, one time we went there, and, you know, by the way, it's close to Indian burial grounds. I think it's Indian burial grounds or Indian mounds. But, you know, they've talked about the mound builders being around the planet, these mounds. So there's something already historically haunted around about this area. And then obviously, you know, NJ is considered a haunted place. New Jersey is considered a very haunted state. Upstate New York and New Jersey, Hudson Valley, which is where we also did a lot of research. Letchworth Village, the place I mentioned we shot there, was a mental hospital for kids. And that's right next to the Hudson Valley. That was a very, very messed up place where we went to this place called House of the Damned. House of the Damned is a house on Letchworth Village property where a notorious story was that a Catholic priest had been ritualistically raping, cannibalizing, and using these kids for ritual purposes in the house. And we went to the house and entirely sure what what we saw, because we heard so many screams and noises and like insane rumblings inside the house, like it was literally resonating with that, with evil. That, you know, you say, I don't, you know, are these places haunted by ghosts, or is it a portal to a demonic dimension, or is it just a negative energy that's been created through black magic that, you know, is never released? I tend to think more towards that, that what happens is it has to do with a certain geometry of location in physical space. It has to do with a history that's created by, you know, the energy that we bring, because everyone, obviously, we bring our mind state to a place. We don't just, when people talk about our energy, it's like our mind state, what is in our imagination, what is in our thoughts and our intentions. So if you bring like a very confused or, you know, an energy of madness to a location, I think people can help and also conjure demons. I think people, by giving their intention, their thoughts towards, you know, evil urgings or evil intent, malicious thoughts, they can help to create that sphere of monsters, let's say. Those monsters, then, that were created, let's say, in a gray stone, live on, because there's nothing there to counteract it. There's no blessing that takes place. But you have continuously people coming there to, you know, to practice more magic, to then feed more into that negative history, and no one coming there to bless it, to cleanse, to forgive, to clean. And I think that's really what it is. It's just that it's a trapped place of sorrow and pain.
So mental, thousands and thousands of mental patients who were there, troubled people, leave some sort of psychic residue that still can manifest itself.
Well, they also died there. I mean, that's the thing. You know, you have mass burial area of about 3,000 people that were buried there, at least 3,000.
You made this into a sort of a theatrical, dramatic film instead of a documentary. I mean, it's a documentary kind of style, a found video kind of theme, which has been very successful, and a lot of movies made hundreds of millions of dollars. Why not a documentary? Why this approach?
Well, to be honest with you, I have footage from this other place, House of the Damned, which was, this is a place where the Catholic priest was sacrificing the kids, as legend goes. And that I documented because we had a little video camera, and the stuff that we went through was so intense with possession. Friends getting possessed and attacking us, and marks, and just crazy phone calls. And the amount of insane things that I have on camera was like far beyond anything I've seen from a handheld film, but this is documentary. That was documented stuff. I have to cut that and put that into a film. That just takes time and energy, and I haven't gone there because Greystone was before. I started Greystone before it. And Greystone, you know, we'd never had enough events that were like, how do you say, that were cinematic.
Sure.
To make that into a documentary. We scripted it based on our feelings about the overall supernatural. And so when you see Greystone Park, you'll see it's something where we shoot handheld. We actually have, we shoot it in haunted places like Letchworth Village, like Linda Vista in L.A., like Creedmoor in Queens. And we wanted it really to shoot in those haunted places because you'll see when sometimes we act possessed, we act like we're really getting into a different state of mind, or we're reacting to the environment. A lot of that's real because it's a real haunted location. So we're really hearing things. We're really responding to the location, but there was still a story that we wanted to tell, which was how your fears, the stories that you tell in the beginning of the movie. We're having dinner with my father and Alex, going back to, like, you know, the origin of all this. We're having dinner, and my dad's telling his ghost story about a crazy old lady who was in the woods at night when he was camping, and he saw her face and it terrified him. Or the legend of Billy Lasher, and this is a guy who Alex took a picture of and showed me, and he really thinks he was in there in Greystone, living there after it was burned, after the place was shut down, and he looked horribly burned, and he looked like a patient who had escaped. He had a gas mask on, and, you know, Alex was terrified of this guy, but he did show me a picture of him. So, you know, I'm not entirely sure if it's just Alex making it up or not, but the point is that sure is real. Like, I've seen him in Greystone. He was, he created a story around him. Being like,
Sean, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. I'm sorry. That's a good point. It's a bad point to interrupt you, but the music tells us we have to take a break. We'll continue the conversation about Greystone Park and then get into Jesse Ventura's conspiracy theory when we come back.